My name's David. I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, David.
How's the body?
Good. Seems good.
I'd like to start with a moment of silence, followed by the wee version of the Serenity Prayer. Serenity Prayer. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I always wondered about that wee version of the Serenity Prayer, and I was taught early on that I had to read every day, and I come very close to doing that, and I've been through the 12 and 12, well, Recovery Continues is the quickest book to get through. I was also taught to read a maximum of one or two pages a day, so I adhere to that. And so if it's a half page, it's just a freebie, right, or the beginning of a chapter or something. And so I started, and I was also told to start on the title page. So I started on the title page and just worked my way through. And so Recovery Continues is the quickest to go through. And then 12 and 12 is the next quickest. And then the white book and then the A Big Book. A Big Book takes about 9 months to do a cycle. And I had been through 12 and 12, half a dozen times maybe, when one day I realized the wee version of the Serenity Prayer is right here at the end of step 12. And the I version is at the end of step, I think it's 3 if I remember. And yet I hadn't seen it. And that's been my experience. Not 3, I have a long step. Anyway, I have experienced over and over again the reality that there is stuff in these books, after as many times as I've read them, that it's that brand new. Last night we were reading Tradition 1, and I heard something in Tradition 1 that's been there all along, but I hadn't heard it until last night. And what happens is the words don't change, but I change, and my willingness and openness to hear and understand things and tie them in different ways or to bring pieces of myself together changes. And so I keep reading because it's always fun. I used to say for many, a long time, remember part of my disease is hallucinations and delusions, and I used for a long time, I thought that the AA Central Office in New York City had a way of changing the Big Book because they would put stuff in there that was not there the last time I read it. And the same with the 12 and 12, and of course, again, the problem is me. I wanted to talk about the traditions, and I can't do that without putting on a tie, because that's what my sponsor, Jess Lair, taught me. He said, David, do you dress up when you go to church? And I said, yes. And he said, which has done more to save your life, church or SA? And I said, SA. And he said, well, then you damn well dress up to go to SA, at least when you're a speaker. And now, Jess was pretty vain, those of you who know him know that. And so he dressed up. Not only did he dress up really beautifully, but you had to notice. And if you didn't notice, he made sure you did. So we all have our deals. But the fact is, it kind of really got drummed into me. And I don't always do it, and yet I'm always aware of it. And I thought, I'm going to talk about the traditions. One of the least things I could do is adhere to tradition. Because that's what the traditions are for our fellowship, and it's one reason why I want to say something about them and spend a little time on them. They are the steps are the path, the program of recovery. That's exactly the words that are in the book. The traditions are the collected experience of what the early AA, starting in 1935 and culminating pretty much about 1951, found that it took to make this work, to make it actually be a living, continuing, functioning program. And so we literally, having been, you know, ne'er-do-wells coming along in 1979, we are terribly indebted to not only AA and the literature there, but also to what they discovered and what they recorded in those traditions, because we literally wouldn't have had it. If that hadn't happened. And I'm so glad we don't have to find out what would have happened if we didn't have it, because we do. And what the traditions have become for AA, as I understand it, is that model not, as they often say, as a series of musts or, you know, it has to be done this way, shalls, that's the word I'm looking for. But as it, the sort of, this is what it's going to take to continue the fellowship. And equally importantly, and this is really my personal attachment to the traditions, that all the traditions must be worked in our own lives, just as we must work the steps. And that's what I'd like to talk about for the next few minutes. Lunch is at noon, right? So I'm going to make, I'd like to end about 5 of, and I would like to sort of open everything to questions about a quarter of. So I'd like about 20 minutes, and if someone around a quarter of would start doing something, gets my attention, I'll wind up and we'll just go to questions. And we could do it sooner. Let me say on the traditions, if you have a question that's really just bubbling in you and you want to ask it, that's fine, stop. Otherwise, I'll just talk for 20 minutes. The traditions are increasingly, I found over the last 10 years that it's less and less common for me to go to an SA meeting where the traditions aren't read, that people are reading them as part of the meetings. And it's pretty normal now at retreats and in international conferences to spend breakout groups, and that's very much happening here. You just did, what, 5, 3, 5, and 11, I think. And so they are moving up in importance. One of our old-timers, some of you may know her, Robin Ann, has talked at several internationals now about having a tradition sponsor, and other people have begun to do that. Oh, I'm blocking on his name, the old-timer in Southern California. It won't come to me, but there's a guy there whose wife founded Essanon, so I should remember.
Ted Pete.
Ted has just been a tremendous power and insistence on the importance of the traditions, and anytime, he's not physically able to do it anymore, but anytime he could physically give a workshop on the traditions, he would do it. In Nashville, one of the co-founders, along with Hardy, of SA in Nashville was Gene P. And Gene was moving from Nashville up to Indiana, and before she left, did a series of very well-attended, like 70 people, at a session on all 12 steps. She planned it way ahead, and then all 12 traditions. And it was just wonderful. It was the first real immersion in that we've had. And at the same time, it was a chance to allow the traditions to percolate through, not only in terms of making the groups work better in the intergroup and all that, but also to bring it into our lives. Last night, we had a breakout meeting on Tradition 1, and I was talking about how, for me, as a sexaholic, that awareness that common welfare is more important than David's welfare. And I had, somewhere around age 3, I can date it solidly from 4 on, so somewhere around age 3, I checked out from that kind of setup and made a decision that David's welfare was more important. When I, in Out of the Shadows, when I read Karn's list of characteristics, believing that there was something inherently wrong with me, okay, got that one right away, and that I couldn't trust anybody else to to meet my needs, okay, got that one right away, and that my primary need was sex, that was certainly true, and that I had to have it. And I just identified with those, but the thing that kind of kept it all together was that I couldn't trust anybody else. And so every decision, every reaction was made in reference to I am separate. The first time I heard Clancy, the AA speaker, say, you know, our flag is just this plain colored flag that just has the words on it, but you don't understand, I'm different from you. He said, that's a we all rally under that one. And again, that was me. And then in 12 and 12, in step 12, where it says that the common personality traits that the Yale study found that we have are that we're grandiose, overly sensitive, and childish. And that was me, you know, and I thought, wow, somebody understands. And all of those things are, you know, my stuff first. And grandiose, overly sensitive, and childish kind of, you know, summarizes it very nicely. And to have that sense that the common welfare of the group, of other people, of my wife, my kids, of my, you know, people I work with, co-workers, and my employer, the community. I remember I was evaluated as part of the hassle around my occupation. I was evaluated, and the evaluator said, well, as long as David has good, solid sobriety, and as long as he keeps going to meetings and doing the stuff he's doing, he'll probably be no threat whatsoever to anybody. And I was really glad to hear that. And then he said, and if he does ever act out again, he'll be a perpetrator and should be held accountable for the consequences of that. And that really hit me. You know, perpetrator is like the kind of thing we use for kids, right? And but that seems exactly right. And I thanked him. I heard it in a different way. That once I have come to SA, before I knew I was a sexaholic, before someone knew that I was an alcoholic who was saying this, before I knew I was a sexaholic, I was not responsible for my behavior. There might be consequences for which I'd be held responsible, but I had a disease and it led me into these situations and I couldn't do anything about it. Once I came to Sexaholics Anonymous and raised my hand and said, I am a sexaholic, I am totally responsible because I have been given the solution. And if I don't want to pick it up, fine. But I'm a perpetrator if I don't use it. And I didn't like that, but it was true. But the truth is, the common welfare is that there doesn't need to be one more sexual perpetrator loose on society. And you better do, David, what you need to do to be sober today. Personal recovery depends on SA unity. That is, I can't have that access to that common welfare unless I have Sexaholics Anonymous. I can't live the life I want to lead unless there's a fellowship around me. And that's why I don't trash SA, I don't say negative things, hopefully, about SA as a fellowship. But, you know, sometimes I gossip and people, you know, get on my nerves. And then I have to make an amends if I've done something bad. Said something bad, but most of the time I, you know, don't. Because if we don't have this fellowship, I'm dead meat, and I will not have the solution that works. For our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Again, you know, my group conscience always took place between my ears. I love that line. The first time I read it, now this I did pick up the first time through 12 and 12. And when it's talking about step 5, and it's saying, why do we have to admit to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs? Why is it another human being? And it says, well, it's because we rapidly get used to the idea that God knows all about us. And the first time I read that, I thought, that's exactly it, you know. I'm quite willing to be honest. Of course, I'm not really being honest, but in my mind, I'm being honest to myself, you know. And years and years ago, a young man, a colleague, was drunk and mad at me about something. I don't remember what it was. And he said, you know, David, you're very truthful. You always say the truth as you see it, but you're not very honest. And boy, I was ticked off at him for years for saying that, because I later came to realize he was right. But I wasn't very honest. I wasn't honest at all, as a matter of fact. He didn't know my secrets. I didn't know my secrets. The fact that I had just, shortly before he said that, as a matter of fact, tried to seduce a 14-year-old and then stopped, but nonetheless did a lot of damage, and very serious damage to her, as it turned out. And, you know, it was terrible, and it was one of the amends I've had to make indirect in that case. But I was not honest at all. I was truthful. I was really great, you know, different kinds of truth. But being honest was not easy. And so the loving God who's going to express himself in group conscience is going to have to come from outside my ego, from outside my best understandings, my clever interpretations, my sharp, witty observations, or my total befuddlement, or my confusion, or my, you know, depression, or it doesn't really matter. If the sentence begins with I or my, I'm in trouble. If it begins with we, then I have a fighting chance, which is why all 12 steps begin with we, because we all need a fighting chance to do this. So the loving God, as he may express himself in a group conscience, is that that's where I'm going to hear God. And somewhere early on, I realized this, and then much later attached to the tradition, that, well, I heard it from an AA guy who said he listens hard at every meeting because he knows that there's one person at that meeting who's going to say exactly what it is God needs him to hear that day. The problem is he doesn't know who it is. And I very rarely sit in a meeting without that in my mind. And I know each person who speaks, and it certainly happened here, is God talking to me in some way. Now, my ability to get the wax out of my ears or to get the dreams out of my head, that's another story. But I know God's working through that group conscious, through each person. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. I rely on that one a lot, partly because I've been in a lot of service positions, partly because it's just the perils of being around a while. And the one thing I know for sure is that I'm the same sexaholic, the same sex drunk I was the day I walked in August 2nd, 1988. And I can share my experience, strength, and hope, but I have no more authority than what God gives me in the situation than I had the day I walked in. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop lusting and become sexually sober. And like AA, I think our desire is to also say, at least my desire, anyone who feels they can benefit from SA needs to be here. Now, that takes real concrete forms for me. It has nothing to do with, you know, having a sobriety definition. That's what we have. No sex with self, no sex with any partner other than the spouse. That is what we offer. We don't, everything else you can get somewhere else. Only here can you get that. And that's, and it only works for sexaholics. It doesn't work for other kinds of people. That's what we say, and what is a sexaholic? But for us, that's our goods. That's what we sell, sobriety. And at the same time, if someone has a desire for it, it'll save their lives, save their marriages, save their jobs, save their kids, save their integrity, whatever. And it's really, the core of who we are functionally, I think. And that's the step, the tradition you're just talking about. But for me personally, it's this, the reminder that I have to have that desire on a daily basis to surrender lust and to have a desire to remain sexually sober, to become and remain sexually sober. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or Sexaholics Anonymous as a whole. Again, I can have my opinions, I can have my friends, I can have my favorite meetings. This responsibility to the whole fellowship, though, is always present too. And to take public positions, to do things that would be embarrassing to the fellowship, all of those things will not only affect the fellowship, but they'll affect me. And I am a part of a larger group, and I'm always responsible for the well-being of that group to the extent that it's in my hands for whatever period of time in whatever form God wants it there. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the sexaholic who still suffers. What occurred to me last night as we were doing the first tradition is that it has always said our common welfare should come first. But I have never put the emphasis until last night on the word first. That is the thing that has to happen first, for me personally, for the fellowship. And as I said last night, it was just like, whoa, you know? And it was just something a couple people said as we were going around the circle. That's what I mean by God speaking through people. It's the same way with Tradition 5 for me. The primary purpose, the one thing we have to do, is to carry the message to the sexaholic who still suffers. The one thing that I have to do is to carry the message to the sexaholic who still suffers. It does not mean I have to make meetings better or that I have to, you know, judge someone else's sobriety or lack thereof, or that I have to come up with, you know, some clever writings or clever kinds of ways of, you know, organizing programs and any of that stuff. It's the whole thing is this primary purpose. And primary and first are basically the same thing. So we're back again to first things first. And common welfare is first, and the first purpose to carry the message. Because not only will that save the fellowship, but more importantly, it'll save me. As it says on page 89 in the next session, Betty very carefully brought her big book and pencil as I instructed, but it's for the session right after lunch, so we'll need it. But for the next session, anytime we're struggling, as the AA Big Book says, the most useful, the most important thing I can do is go work with another drunk, you know. And that's tradition five practiced in my life. If I want to keep my life today, which I really, really do, in whatever way God wants me to have it, then I'm going to have to do that. The other thing, too, is that, and I think I shared this, it might have been the breakout group, I think it was, actually. When newcomers, this went on for, probably 8-9 years, newcomers would come to meetings, and I would just about crawl out of my skin. I very rarely had to leave the room, but I would be so uncomfortable. My jaw would be getting tight, and my head would be starting to spin, because they were sharing whatever raw pain they were coming in with. And I would just go crazy. And I knew I was being judgmental, which is one of my major character defects. I knew I was being unaccepting. I knew that if I spotted I got it, what I was being uncomfortable about was in them, was really the stuff in me, like when that guy called me a perpetrator, you know. And yet the reality is that I just had to relax and breathe into it and let God be in charge. And what happens, and you all have experienced this, I'm sure, is that over a period of weeks, these newcomers who made me want to crawl out of my skin get better, and their lives stabilize, and they learn the lingo, which helps a little bit. But they also begin to change, and frequently, the more crazy I felt when they came in, the more I really, really like them as they get healthier. And I've just had to translate that fifth tradition in that way, that my job is to carry the message. Their suffering, as it says in 12 and 12, becomes more and more evident as we go forward that it's pointless to get angry or hurt by people who, like ourselves, are suffering from the pains of growing up. And that's what's going on, and the fifth tradition is what keeps me in my seat. SA Group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the SA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. That's real practical in terms of the fellowship, and we see situations where people try to get around that tradition, and it's just a disaster. But more importantly, when I connect my, and I was sharing this with someone during the last hour, when I connect my sexual addiction recovery, my sobriety, to some endorsement, some financial arrangement, someone, and fairly well known actually in our fellowship, really got into selling a particular product that was sort of a pyramid sales thing, and started working with people in the fellowship to doing that. It just drove me nuts. Personally, because it just felt wrong. Well, what it was a violation of Tradition 6, not in terms of SA, in fact, they were always very careful about that, but in terms of their relationships to me, because they wanted me to sell this product, to each other. I watched two people who had been friends their entire time in SA, and this was well over 10 years at that point, just literally blow up so badly they could never repair it. And one of them died, and that's the way it stands. It's never been repaired. And it's a violation of sixth tradition, because an outside thing, in this case a financial thing, was brought into their lives, into their recovery. And I'm so grateful to them, because there's part of me that wants to do that. I'm not attached to money itself, but I can spend it as well as anybody. And I know I could go that way. With me, though, it's more likely lending the SA name. You know, lending my experience, my sobriety, my recovery, my whatever. You know, and again, it'd be a violation of sixth tradition for me to do it personally, because it would be a problem of money, property, and prestige diverting me from carrying the message. I might withhold some of the message. It's like people do, scientists are starting to do. They're patenting their work instead of making it available for science. And it'd be like me, it's patenting a piece of SA, so I let it out in little dribs and drabs. You know, well, it's a sixth tradition violation, and it's not going to be any more successful for me than it's never been for anybody else. Every SA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. This is probably the one tradition that I can promise you everyone in this room is going to have a direct experience with, because we all have money problems, one form or another. At least everybody I've ever met does. And this whole business of being self-supporting for our own contributions and coming to terms with that. I've had experience over the years now to see totally unrelated to SA, how devastating. I really believe in Social Security. I believe in Social Security disability payments and all that. And I have also seen it pretty uniformly destroy people. And it's like, wow, that's a tough one. It really is tough. But that's a situation where they don't have a choice. They really need it, and it's there for them, and I'm glad it is. But inside the fellowship, I see people do this all the time, and you find funny examples of it. This AA speaker, Johnny A., says, you can always tell how an alcoholic's doing. If you want to know, you just say, hi, hey, where are you living? And if they say, well, I'm just staying with people, just sort of hanging out, you know, kicking back with folks for a while, just thought they might want me home, you know. And he said, you know, if they don't have a place to live, they're homeless, in other words, even if they're crashing a lot, they're doing terribly. And if they have a place to live, they're probably doing okay. And that's the way the seventh tradition gets worked out in our lives. It's not just money, but it's those things that go to being fully self-supporting. And all this, the equivalent personal growth, integrity, focus. I have a guy, a sponsor right now, who it took me a year and a half of him telling me this stuff for me to realize that any time he talked to me about money, he was lying. I mean, he wasn't lying. He was telling me a fantasy. So he called me up and said, got this great contract. He's in advertising. This is going to be really a wonderful $10,000 contract. What that meant was he had had lunch with someone who said, you know, there's a $10,000 contract that we're going to be awarding to someone. You want to apply for it? You know. And he had spent it, and you know, and his life had been made whole by this. And then, of course, he never got the contracts. And, you know, and that's going on to this day. Went on yesterday. Did we talk yesterday? Day before, I guess. But the thing is, now he says it. He still says the same stuff, and I say, nah, you're lying. Tell me the truth. What's really going on? So he called me up last week and said, I got this great new job. I'm going to be editing, proofreading this stuff. And then finally it turned out he'd been told he might get a temp job doing this, and then it later fell through, and that's where. That's what fully self-supporting throwing contributions means. It also means being honest about what we're doing. Sexaholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. I think I have 2 minutes here, so I'll get through 8 and 9, maybe I'll pass. Forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. What that has meant for me is the literal, not professionalizing, 12-step recovery and how important that is, and that we don't do it. And that also we do have service centers, but also in my own life, to keep my use and my understanding of spiritual recovery, to keep it freely available, to not professionalize it. Professionalizing means passing it on as an expert and to charge money for it. And I can't do those things safely. I can do them, but not without violating the tradition. And more importantly, I can use others to do that perfectly safely. I can refer people. I can send them to books. I can, you know, we have special workers all over the place. And it's my willingness to use them and not think I have to be in the center of every picture for every person, which may seem a little ridiculous when I say it out loud, but it's the way my brain works. SA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. This, in some ways, this is the most obscure of all the traditions in some ways, and to me, in many ways, it's been one of the most important ones personally, and that's one reason I wanted to talk about it. And that is, in my life, I can be a part of committees, I often am, I can be a part of projects, I can just have things that are part of my job that I do, or family obligations and stuff, as long as I'm directly responsible to those I'm serving. That my mindset has to be service, and I have to see myself as responsible, not as the boss, not as the wise guy, not as the expert, or not even as the flake and the guy who doesn't do anything, you know. I have to see it as service, and I have to be responsible. And I have to, I don't have to do it in some rigid, systematic way, planning out my life, planning out my week, whatever. I'm tempted to do that often, but I don't have to do that. I don't have to be organized, as long as I'm willing to serve and be directly responsible. As obscure as that tradition is, in many ways, in practical terms for the groups, it's actually become one of the most important to me personally. And I was quite surprised by that. I did not expect that. At the same time, it saved me an awful lot of grief. let me say on 10 on outside issues, I think having no opinion on outside issues as for AA has turned out to be so important. I have read over the years quite a few articles trashing Alcoholics Anonymous one way or another. I've never seen AA respond. I have often wanted to respond for them. Thank you very much. And I've not done it. And what I have seen over time is that the critics melt away. In Nashville, we were the leading center of controlled drinking sobriety for a long time. And it was very critical of AA, and I got pretty panicky at one point about all that. And you know what happened? It literally moved out of town, and it all melted away. It just doesn't hold up. And the key is, am I going to let God be in charge of outcomes, or am I going to try to make David in charge of outcomes? And that's really what it turns out to be on the outside issues. I think I'll not talk about it, 11 and 12, even though they're terribly important. After all, in addition to common welfare first, primary purpose in step 5, then 12 says anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. But I'm going to talk more about anonymity and spiritual foundation in the next hour, so I'll come back to that one. I promised I'd open it up to questions and curiosities, and I hadn't done enough that the first time, so this is yours, and we'll wind up around 5:00 for a couple minutes, so we have time to get to lunch. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
Anybody?
I have a question. I'm very self-centered. I took that personal when you said flake.
Well, I'm always happy to have, Flakes Anonymous, so
that's fine.
I use bad language against myself. One of the things is I have a phrase, if I spot it, it's not original with me at all, it's one I just recite a lot. If I spot it, I got it. And one of the reasons it's so important to me is I will never see anything in someone else that isn't really true in me. And that's why I'm seeing it in them in the first place. And a long time I thought, well, most of the time that's true. And about 5 years into the program, I just changed the most to always. It's always been true. What it's done is it's given me an opportunity, first of all, to learn about myself. As soon as I've taken your inventory, I told myself something I probably need to know. And secondly, it also keeps me from getting knocked off balance when someone says, well, you're a flake, David. Well, as Bill W. says, when someone says something like that, you first say, is it true? If it is true, okay, change. Maybe it's partly true. If it's partly true, then do something about that part of it. If none of it's true, then just remember they're sick people just like you and love them as they are. And that has allowed me to stay in balance when I remember it, which is more times than not. So anyway, Flakes Anonymous. I'll be with you.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Rich, sexaholic. And you skipped number 11, and I want to hear your comment about it. Dr. Bob wrote very specifically and also spoke very specifically about using our whole names. And Bill Wilson wrote and spoke a lot about the fact that by not knowing each other within the family, that we kind of become sort of a cell or a secret organization, which wasn't the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I notice you introduce yourself by your whole name, as I do too. And I try to encourage that in other people. What could you share with us about that?
Well, I had said I was going to skip on that, but you invited me to share, and I'll be very brief. I think attraction rather than promotion is exactly where it's at. If someone hears, first of all, it's what my sponsor does, what both my sponsors of that sort did, all my sponsors, except for the first one, actually do it. And I find it attractive. I find it grounds me in the room. I also know that I have a very strong exhibitionist streak. And so I have found that I'm a boundary invader by definition. My sponsor taught me that. And one of the boundaries I will invade is to, I was talking with someone about this during the break, is to break my anonymity when it's really inappropriate. And I have had pretty severe consequences for that and have gotten much, much better on that. I happen to agree with what you said, that inside the fellowship, I want people to be able to look me up in the phone book if they lose my number. If there's 3 David M's, which it's not uncommon, I want them to know which one I am and to know who they are. If guys ask me to sponsor pretty regularly, you know, like most of you have learned, it's fine to say yes because most of them never call anyway. But the first thing I'll do is say, that's great. What's your last name, Bob? And then there's this deep silence. You know, then they finally say it. But, you know, it's the beginning of, for me, it's the beginning of honesty and about who I am. And that's why, and that's the attraction for me. I need that honesty. That's the guy, that young man said years ago, I have trouble with honesty. But not everybody needs that. They may need something else. And they may have other perfectly good reasons for only using their last names. So I don't judge them. I just do what I do. Other people?
How about the, you've been involved in a lot of service work at an international level. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started doing that? What have been some of the challenges? You mentioned a little bit about the tradition itself.
Yeah. Sponsoring people in service work have certainly many, many times. I said, was it last... this morning, you know, that I had to add to my daily contract on not touching my penis for sexual stimulation because I just had an experience with it a month ago that I nearly would have lost my sobriety if I hadn't recoiled as if from a hot flame. And I did, but, you know, this disease is just as serious and just as deadly and cunning, baffling, and powerful today as it's always been. There have been many occasions when things of that sort, you know, contacts with women, fantasies, allowing myself to get aroused, whatever, taking in images. If I didn't have the people I sponsor or the service work, I might have gone with it. I don't know. It really has allowed me to stay sober. And specifically in Nashville, I got involved initially with, we had an international coming, and this is a good example of this. We were doing the international in January of 1990, so about April 1989, we had our first meeting, and we met, I was before or after our Saturday afternoon meeting, and there was, maybe 12, 15 of us in a real tiny room, so we were kind of crowded in there, and Harvey was chairing the international, and he looked around the room, and he said, you know, as we're planning for this international, we have to remember that half of us sitting in this room will not be in the fellowship in January. And so we need to remember that whatever we plan isn't dependent on a particular person. And that really, wow, that shook me up. But I was determined I was going to be there, you know. And in fact, I think only one person wasn't there. And it was probably partly because he said that. And I think everybody had a similar reaction. Well, darn it, it's not going to be me. And so I, at that conference, I sold literature. I did the literature table. And that kind of began. In 1991 in Chicago, Roy, in a formal way, passed the fellowship with no warning, passed the run administration of the fellowship to SA as a whole. So I was a part of a group of, I think about 12 of us or 10 of us, somewhere in there, who formed the Central Office Oversight Committee and began to manage the Central Office. And I have actually been on that, in that role with Central Office since then, so whatever that is, 14 years, I guess. And also in the finance role that goes with that. In the mid-1990s, I went on the Literature Committee, and since the late 1990s, I've been the chair of that committee, International Literature Committee. Starting in 2001, when Roy... 2002, whichever year it was, 2001, Roy removed our ability to sell the white book for a period of time. Well, actually, we still can't sell it, but removed our access to it. Then we have really been focusing on generating literature for the fellowship. And for a number of years, I was editor of the essay, which I passed on a while ago. But so, and all of that was for the purpose of just being sure that Central Office was surviving in specific, and the SA as a fellowship had literature available to it on a consistent basis. Things have since sort of rectified themselves in terms of access anyway, on the white book, and recovery continues, and that's helped a lot. But we're still doing it, so I'm involved in those things. And then locally, you know, I just get involved in helping get meetings going and And certainly, as I said, I sponsor probably way too many people. Does that answer your question? Other people? Maybe one more and then we'll quit, if there is one. How are people here on the seventh step prayer? Familiar, unfamiliar?
Familiar.
Familiar? Let's close with that. Let's form a circle.
Let's have a moment of silence for the sexaholics still suffering in and outside these rooms. Seventh step prayer.
I am Creator.
I'm now willing
that you should have all of me,
good and bad.
I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen.
Keep coming back. It works if you work.
It's work because you're worth it.
Now I can take this tie off, Jess.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, David.